There's many more secreted away somewhere. Most men counted wealth in coins. Valentinian counted wealth in blades. How are you feeling? Asked Belisarius. Valentinian's narrow face grew even more pinched.
Not too well, sir, to be honest. I stopped seeing double, at least. But my head still hurts more often than not, and I don't have much strength back.
Valentinian glanced at the Malwa sitting in the open pavilion. They were out of hearing range. Demodera had politely allowed Valentinian to meet Belisarius alone.
I'll do my best, he whispered, if there's any trouble. But I've got to warn you that I'm not my old self. Not yet, anyway.
Belisarius smiled.
There won't be any trouble. And if there is, we'll have Sangha to protect us.
Valentinian grimaced.
Pity those poor bastards. God, that man's a demon.
Gingerly, he touched the light helmet on his head.
I don't ever want to do that again, I'll tell you for sure. Not without him tied up and me using grenades.
Again, Valentinian glanced at the enemy in the pavilion. This time, however, it was a look of respect rather than suspicion.
I've been well treated, General.
Pampered like a lord, if you want to know the truth.
Sangha himself has come to visit me any number of times. Even Demodera.
A look of bemusement came to his face.
He's actually a friendly sort of fellow, the fat little bugger. Odd for a Malwa. Even got a sense of humor. Pretty good one.
Belisarius shrugged.
Why is that odd? The Malwa are humans, Valentinians, not gods.
Belisarius gave his own quick glance at the pavilion, which is the reason when the dust settles that the new gods will find Malwa has failed them. They're trying to make perfection out of something which is not only imperfect by nature, but must be. Only imperfect things can grow, Valentinian. Striving for perfection is as foolish as it is vain.
You can only create a statue, a thing which may look grand on a pedestal, but will not stand up so well in the field of battle.
Belisarius brought his eyes back to Valentinian.
You swore an oath, I assume.
Valentinian nodded. For a moment, he seemed uncomfortable. Not ashamed, simply awkward, like a peasant in the company of royalty. Men of Valentinian's class and station didn't swear solemn oaths with the same practiced ease that nobility did.
Yes, sir. They stopped putting a guard over me. But I had to swear that I would make no attempt to escape and that I wouldn't fight except in self-defense. And I'll have to go back with them, of course, after this parley.
Valentinian's feral weasel grin made its appearance.
On the other hand, they didn't make me swear I'd keep my mouth shut.
Another glance at the pavilion.
I've learned some things, General. Real quick. You were right about Demodera's arms complex. It's in Marv, just like Vasudeva thought it might be. They'll have their own hand cannons soon enough. The Malwa have already started making them in Kaushambi, but Demodera is boasting that he'll have his own made in Marv.
Belisarius shook his head.
He wasn't boasting, Valentinian, and he didn't tell you by accident. He knows you'll pass on the information. He wants me to have it.
Valentinian frowned.
Why would he do that?
Because he's a very smart man. Smart enough to understand something which few generals do. Sometimes a secret given away can serve as well as a secret kept, or even better. He's probably hoping I'll try to make a raid on Marv once he forces me out of the Zagros, rather than retreating into Mesopotamia. The city's in an oasis, and I'm sure he's got it fortified like Satan's jaws. He'd be eaten alive trying to storm the place, and the few table scraps would be snapped up in the desert. Valentinian squinted at him as if he were seeing double. His hand again touched his helmet gingerly.
Christ, he muttered. How can you stand to think all crooked like that? My head hurts just trying to follow.
He made a little hiss.
And I still don't understand why Demodera would do it. He can't really think you'd fall for it.
Belisarius shrugged. Probably not, but you never know. It's worth a try. He scratched his chin. The man's a lot like me, I believe, in some ways, at least. He likes an oblique approach, and he keeps his eye on all the angles. Another hiss came from Valentinian.
God, my head hurts.
Belisarius took Valentinian by the arm and began leading him toward the pavilion. As they neared, walking slowly, Valentinian remembered something else.
Oh, yeah. Morris was right about Narses, too. He's...
Belisarius nodded. He had already spotted the small figure of the old eunuch in the shade of the pavilion. He smiled crookedly.
I imagine by now that Narses is running the whole show for Demodera.
Valentinian grinned. It was an utterly murderous expression.
Would you believe how successful that raid was?
You know, the cavalry raid against the Malwa camp that you must have ordered, even though I never knew about it, and I was right by your side the whole time. Belisarius grinned himself.
A brilliant stroke that was.
So brilliant that my own memory is blinded.
Mine too, concurred Aide.
Firmly.
But I'm sure you must have ordered it. And I'm quite sure the raid was a roaring success.
Killed every one of Demodera's top spies, murmured Valentinian. They were almost at the pavilion.
Vicious Romans slit their throats, neat as you could ask for.
They were entering the pavilion now. Valentinian moved aside, and Belisarius strode to the low table at the center. Demodera and Sangha nodded a greeting. Demodera was smiling, Sangha stiff and solemn. Narses, sitting far back from the table, was glaring, but he too managed a nod. Gracefully, with the practiced ease of his time in India, Belisarius folded himself into a lotus and took a seat on one of the cushions. He saw no reason to waste time on meaningless diplomatic phrasery. What is the purpose of this parley? He asked. The statement, for all the brusqueness of the words, was not so much a demand as a simple inquiry.
I can't see where there's any military business to discuss.
He waved at Valentinian. Unless you've changed your mind about his ransom. Demodera chuckled. Belisarius continued.
So what's the point of talking? You're trying to get into Mesopotamia, and I'm trying to stop you.
Slow you down, more precisely.
You've managed to drive me almost out of the Zagros. We're not so many miles from the floodplains now, but I kept you tied up for months in the doing. That's bought time for Emperor Khosrow, and time for my general Agathias to build up the Roman forces in Mesopotamia.
Belisarius shrugged. I'm going to keep doing it, and you're going to keep doing it. Sooner or later, sooner probably, I'll give up the effort and retreat to Peroshapur, maybe Ctesiphon, maybe somewhere else. Then we'll fight it out in the open. I imagine you're looking forward to that, but you won't enjoy it when the time comes. So much I can promise.
Demodera shook his head, still smiling. I didn't ask for this parley in order to discuss military affairs. As you say, the matter is moot.
Still smiling, very cheerfully, in fact. And I don't doubt for a minute that you'll make it just as tough for us on flat ground as you have in the mountains.
Sangha snorted, as a man does when he hears another man announce that the sun rises in the east.
I asked for this parley, Belisarius, simply because I wanted to meet you. Finally, after all these months. And also,
the Mawa lord hesitated.
And also, because I thought we might discuss the future. The far future, I mean, not the immediate present.
Bullseye. Am I a genius, Aide?
A true and certain genius, came the immediate response. But I still don't understand how you figured it out.
Belisarius leaned forward, preparing to discuss the future.
Because Lord Demodera is a man. The best man of the Malwa, because he's the only one who doesn't dream of being a god. He follows the Malwa gods, true, but he's beginning to wonder, I think, how well his feet of clay will stand the march.
Lord Demodera, began Belisarius.
The general reached up and began unlacing his tunic. Beneath the cloth, nestled in a leather pouch, the future lay waiting, like a tiger hidden in ambush.
You're on, Aide.
There was no uncertainty in the response, neither doubt nor puzzlement.
I'll clean their clocks.
Scornfully.
Polish their sundials, rather.
Demodera almost took Aide in his hand when Belisarius made the offer. But at the end, the Mulwa Lord shied away from the glittering splendor. Partly his refusal was based on simple, automatic distrust, but not much. He didn't really think Belisarius was trying to poison him with some mysterious magical jewel. He believed in his heart of hearts that Belisarius was telling the truth about the incredible gem nestled in his hand. No, the real reason Demodera couldn't bring himself to take the thing was that he finally realized that he didn't want to know the future. He would rather make it himself. Poorly, perhaps, blindly, perhaps, but in his own hands. Pudgy, unprepossessing hands, to be sure. Nothing like the well-formed, sinewy hands of a Roman general or a Rajput king. But they were his hands, and he was sure of them. Sangha wasn't even tempted. "I have seen the future, Belisarius," he stated solemnly. "Link has shown it to me." The Rajput pointed to Aid. "Will that show me anything different?" Belisarius shook his head. "Not at all. The future, unless Link and the new gods change it, with Malwa as their instrument, is just as I'm sure Link showed it to you. A place of chaos and disorder. A world where men are no longer men, but monsters. A universe where nothing is pure and everything polluted." Belisarius lifted his hand, his fingers spread wide. Aid glistened and coruscated like the world's most perfect jewel. "This, too, is a thing of pollution. A monster, an intelligent being created from disease, the worst disease which ever stalked the universe. And yet..." Belisarius gazed down at Aid. "Is he not beautiful? Just like a diamond forged out of rotting waste." Belisarius closed his fingers. Aid's glowing light no longer illuminated the pavilion, and a Roman general watching the faces of his enemies knew that he wasn't the only one who missed the splendor. He turned to Demodera. "Do you have children?" The Mawa Lord nodded. 3. 2 boys and a girl." "Were they born perfectly? Or were they born in blood and your wife's pain and sweat and your own fear?" A shadow crossed the Roman's face. "I have no children of my own. My wife Antonina can bear them no longer. In her days as a courtesan, after she bore one son, she was cut by a man seeking to become her pimp." Those coarse truths spoken by a man about his own wife didn't seem odd to his enemies in the pavilion. They knew the story. Narses had told them what few details the Malwa Espionage Service had not already ferreted out. Yet they knew as well, as surely as they knew the sunrise, that the Roman was oblivious to any shame or disgrace. Not because he was ignorant of his wife's past, but simply because he didn't care. Any more than a diamond nestled with a pearl cares that the pearl was also shaped from waste. The shadow passed, and sunlight returned. "Yet that boy, that bastard sired by a prostitute's customer, has become my own son in truth. As dear to me as if he were born of my own flesh. Why is that, do you think?" Belisarius stared down at the beauty hidden in his fist. "This too, this monster, has become like a son to me. And why is that, do you think?" When he raised his head, the face of the Roman general was as serene as the moon. "The reason, Lord of Malwa and King of Rajputana, was explained to me by Raghunath Rao, in a vision I had of him once, dancing to the glory of time. Only the soul matters in the end. All else is dross." Belisarius returned to Ranasanga. "My wife is a very beautiful woman. Is yours, King of Rajputana?" Sangha stared at the Roman. Belisarius had never met Sangha's wife. For a moment, angrily, Sangha wondered if Rome's spies had... He shook off the suspicion. Belisarius, he realized, was simply making a shrewd guess, looking for any angle from which to drive home the lance. "She is plump and plain-faced," he said harshly. "Her hair was already gray by the time she was 30. Belisarius nodded. He opened his hand. Beauty re-entered the pavilion. "Would you trade her, then, for my own?" Zanga's powerful fingers closed around the hilt of his sword. But after an instant, the gesture of anger became a simple caress. A man comforted by the feel of an old, familiar, trusted thing.
The finest steel in the world was made in India. That steel had saved him times beyond counting. She is my life, he said softly. The mother of my children. The joy of my youth and the certainty of my manhood. Just as she will be the comfort of my old age. Sangha's left hand reached up, gingerly stroking the new scar which Valentinian had put on his cheek. The scar was still angry-looking in its freshness, but even after it faded, Sangha's face would remain disfigured. He'd been a handsome man once, no longer. Assuming, of course, that I reach old age, he said, smiling ruefully, and that my wife doesn't flee in terror when she sees the ogre coming through the door. Again, for a moment, the fingers of his right hand clenched the sword hilt. Powerful fingers. Sangha's smile vanished. I would not trade her for a goddess. The words were as steely as his blade. I didn't think so, murmured Belisarius. He slipped aid back into his pouch and refastened the tunic. I didn't think so, he repeated. He rose and bowed to Demodera. Our business is finished, I believe. Belisarius was a tall man, not as tall as Sangha, but tall enough to loom over Demodera like a giant. He was a big man, too, not as powerful as Sangha, to be sure, but a far more impressive figure than the short and pudgy Malwa lord sitting on a cushion before him. It mattered not at all. Lord Demodera returned the Roman general's gaze with the placidity of a Buddha. Yes, I believe it is, he agreed pleasantly. Demodera now rose himself and bowed to Belisarius. Then he turned slightly and pointed to Narses. Except, Demodera smiled, the very image of a Buddha. You requested that Narses be present. I assume there was a reason. Belisarius examined the eunuch. Throughout the parley, Narses had been silent. He remained silent, although he returned Belisarius's calm gaze with the same glare with which he had first greeted him. I would like to speak to Narses alone, said Belisarius, with your permission. Seeing the distrust in Demodera's eyes, Belisarius shook his head. I assure you, Lord Demodera, that nothing I will discuss with Narses will cause any harm to you. He waited while Demodera gauged the thing, measured the angles, so to speak. That was a beautifully parsed sentence, said Aide admiringly. I had an excellent grammarian. My father spared no expense on my education. Demodera was still hesitating, looking for the oblique approach wherever the damn thing was. That it was there, Demodera didn't doubt for an instant. I will give you my oath on it, if you wish, added Belisarius. Oh, that's good. You're smart, Grandpa. Don't let anybody tell you different. Belisarius almost made a modest shrug, but long experience had taught him to keep his conversations with Aide a secret from those around him. I am a man of honor, but I've never seen where that prevents me from using my honor practically. We Romans are even more practical than the Malwa, way more when push comes to shove. The offer seemed to satisfy Demodera. There's no need, he said pleasantly. Again, he bowed to Belisarius. Then, taking Sangha by the arm, he left the pavilion. Belisarius and Narses were alone. Narses finally spoke.
Fuck you. What do you want?
Belisarius grinned. I just want to tell you your future, Narses. I think I owe you that much for saving Theodora's life.
I didn't do it for you, fuck you.
The old eunuch's glare was a thing of wonder, as splendid in its own way as Aide's coruscating glamour. Sheer hostility, as pure as a diamond, forged out of a lifetime's malice, envy, and self-hatred.
Now what do I care? Demanded the eunuch, sneering. What? Are you going to tell me that I'm an old man right on the edge of the grave? I already know that, you bastard. I'll still make your life as miserable as I can, even while they're fitting me for the shroud.
Belisarius's grin was its own thing of marvel. Not at all, Narses, quite the contrary. He tapped the pouch under his tunic. The future's changed, of course, from what it would have been, but some things will remain the same. A man's natural lifespan, for instance.
Narses glared and glared. Belisarius's grin faded, replaced by a look of sorrow.
Such a waste, he murmured.
Then more loudly, I will tell you the truth, Narses the eunuch. I swear this before God. You will outlive me, and I will not die young. His crooked smile came. Not from natural causes, anyway. In this world which we're creating, who knows what'll happen? But in the future that would have been, I died at the age of 60. You were still alive. Narses' jaw dropped.
You're serious?
For a moment, a lifetime's ingrained suspicion vanished. For that moment, that tiny moment, the scaled and wrinkled face was that of a child again. The infant boy, before he had been castrated and cast into a life of bitterness.
You're really telling me the truth?
I swear to you, Narses, before God himself, that I am speaking the truth. Suspicion returned like a landslide.
Why are you telling me this? Demanded Narses. And don't give me any crap. I know how tricky you are. There's an angle here.
The eunuch's angry eyes scanned the interior of the pavilion and the landscape visible beyond as if looking for the trap. Of course there's an angle, Narses. I should think it's obvious.
Ambition.
Narses' eyes snapped back to Belisarius.
Such a waste, repeated Belisarius.
Then, firmly and surely, I forgive you your treason, Narses the eunuch. Theodora won't, because she cannot abandon her spite. But I can, and I do. I swear to you now before God that the past is forgiven. I ask only in return that you remain true to the thing which brought you to treason.
Your ambition.
Belisarius spread his hands, cupped, like a giant holding an invisible world.
Don't think small, Narses. Don't satisfy yourself with the petty ambition of bringing me down. Think big.
His grin returned.
Why not? You've still got at least 30 more years to enjoy the fruits of your labor.
Narses' quick eyes glanced at Ranasanga. The Rajput king was standing outside, perhaps 40 feet away. He and Demotera were chatting amiably with Valentinian.
Don't be stupid, he hissed. I cleaned up Demotera's nest, sure. He was sick and tired of Nandalal's creatures watching his every move, but more than that?
The great sneer was back in force.
This is a Rajput army, Belisarius, in case you haven't noticed. Those crazy bastards are as likely to violate an oath as you are. They swore eternal allegiance to the Malwa Emperor, and that's that.
Belisarius scratched his chin, smiling crookedly. So they did. But I suggest, if you haven't already, that you investigate the nature of that oath. Oaths are specific, you know. I asked Irene last year to find out for me just exactly what the kings of Rajputana swore at Ajmer when they finally gave their allegiance to Malwa. The smile grew as crooked as a root. They swore eternal allegiance to the Emperor of Malwa, Narses. Belisarius began to leave. At the edge of the pavilion, just within the shade, he stopped and turned around. There was no mention of Skandagupta, by the way. No name, Narses. Just the Emperor of Malwa. He almost laughed then, seeing Narses' face. Again, it was the face of a young boy. Not the face of trusting innocence, however. This was the eager face of a greedy child, examining the cake which his mother had just placed before him in celebration of his birthday. With many more birthdays to come. Lots of them. With lots of cake. On the way back, riding through the Badlands, Aid spoke only once.
Deadly with a blade, is Belisarius.
Chapter 23. The minute Belisarius entered the headquarters tent, he knew. The grinning faces of his commanders were evidence enough. Morris's deep scowl was the proof. He laughed, seeing that morose expression. What's the matter, you old grouch? He demanded. Admit the truth, you just can't stand it when plans go right, that's all. It's against your religion. Morris managed to smile, sort of, if a lemon could smile.
"'Tain't natural," he grumbled. "Against the laws of man and nature."
He held up the scroll in his hand and offered it to Belisarius. Then, shrugging,
"But apparently it's not against the laws of God."
Eagerly, Belisarius unfolded the scroll and scanned its contents. "You read it. It was a statement, not a question." Morris nodded, gesturing to the other officers.
"And I gave them the gist."
Belisarius glanced at the faces of Cyril, Buzis, and Kutsis, and Vasudeva. A Greek, two Thracians, and a Kushan, but they might as well have been peas in a pod. All four men were beaming. Satisfaction, partly, at seeing plans come to fruition. Sheer pleasure in the main, because they were finally done with maneuvers. Except for one last long driving march, of course, but that was a march to battle. That the march would end in triumph, they doubted not at all. Theirs was the army of Belisarius. Not quite peas in a pod. The Kushan's grin was so wide that it seemed to split his face. Belisarius gave him a stern look and shook the scroll admonishingly. "The helmets stay on until we're well into the Kanat, Vasudeva. Any Kushan who so much as sheds a buckle before we're into the passage, I'll have him impaled. I swear I will." Vasudeva's grin never wavered.
"Not to fear, General. We are planning a religious ceremony once we're in. A great mounded pile of stinking, fucking, stupid, barbarian crap. We will say a small prayer condemning the shit to eternal oblivion."
He spread his hands apologetically.
"By rights, of course, we should set it all afire, but..."
Kutsis laughed.
"Not likely. Not unless you want to smother all of us in smoke. It'll be hard enough to breathe as it is with over 10,000 men humping through a tunnel. Even sending them through in batches will be half-suffocating."
Satisfied, Belisarius resumed his examination of the scroll. He wasn't really reading the words, however. The message was so short that it didn't require much study. Simply a date and a salutation. His gaze was fixed on that salutation, like a barnacle to a stone. Two words.
"Thank God we're done with these mountains," stated Buzis. "And those tough Rajput bastards," agreed his brother happily.
Tears welled into Belisarius's eyes. "This message means something much more precious to me," he whispered. He caressed the thin sheet. "It means my wife is still alive." Seeing the sheer joy in Belisarius's face, his commanders fell silent. Then, after clearing his throat, Cyril muttered,
"Yes, sir. Very probably."
Belisarius gave the Greek cataphract a shrewd glance. Cyril's expression, he saw, was mirrored on the faces of the brothers and Vasudeva. Uncertainty, hope for the sake of their general, but... "Shit happens in war," stated Belisarius, verbalizing their unhappy thoughts. "Maybe Antonin is dead. Maybe Ashot sent the message telling us when the fleet would sail from Adolis." He looked at Morris. The Kiliarch was grinning now as hugely as Vasudeva had done earlier. There wasn't a trace of veteran pessimism in that cheerful expression. Belisarius smiled.
"Tell them, Morris."
Morris cleared his throat.
"Well, it's like this, boys. I only told you the gist of the message itself. Ashot might have sent that, sure enough, could have sent it standing over Antonina's bleeding corpse. But I really doubt the stubby bastard would have addressed the general as, and I quote, dearest love, even if he is an Armenian."
The tent erupted with laughter. Belisarius joined in freely, but his eyes were back on the scroll. Dearest love. The two words poured through his soul like wine. Standing in a tent in the rocky Zagros, he felt as if he was soaring through the heavens. Dearest love. They broke for the south 2 days later. Belisarius waited until the next cavalry encounter was over. Just a quick clash between 30 Romans and their equivalent number of Rajputs in a nearby valley. No different from a dozen others, 100 others, which had taken place over the past few months. The encounter, as had usually been the case since the Battle of the Pass, was almost bloodless. Neither side was trying to hammer the other any longer. They were simply staying in touch, making sure that each army knew the location of its opponent. No Roman was killed. Only one was seriously injured, but he swore he could make the march.
"It's just my arm, General," he said, holding up the heavily bandaged limb. "Just a flesh wound. Didn't even lose much blood."
Belisarius had his doubts, but seeing the determination in the cataphract's face, he decided to bring him along. The army had just been informed at daybreak of their new destination. The wounded cataphract wanted to stay with his comrades. At worst, the man would not lose his strength for several days. That was good enough. The general straightened up from his crouch. "All right," he said. He gave the cataphract a look which wasn't grim, simply stoic. "Worst comes to worst, you'll be in Rajput hands." The cataphract shrugged. He was obviously not appalled by the prospect, nor had he any reason to be. The conflict between the two armies, even before the battle in the pass, had been civilized. Thereafter, it had been downright chivalrous. The Rajputs would treat the man as well as Belisarius' soldiers had treated their own Rajput captives. Remembering those captives, Belisarius shrugged himself. "Comes to it," he said, "I'll just leave you behind with the prisoners. Far enough into the Khanat that Demotara won't find you until it's too late, and with plenty of food. You won't need water, of course." The cataphract grimaced slightly at the mention of water. The spring runoff was long over, but the Khanat was still at least a foot deep. For all their eagerness to quit the mountains, none of the soldiers were looking forward to a long march through a tunnel, walking along narrow ledges on the sides lest their feet become soaked by the water pouring through the center passage. Morris came up.
"Now," he said, "couldn't ask for a better time."
Belisarius nodded. It was only mid-morning of the day after the cavalry clash. The Rajput horsemen would have returned to their own army, bringing Demotara the news of the Roman whereabouts. They wouldn't return for at least a day, probably two. Long enough. "Are the men
mounted up and ready?" came Morris's immediate reply. "They're just waiting for the order."
Belisarius took a deep breath, filling his lungs.
"Now," he said.
Quickly, while the clean air of the mountains buoyed him up and stiffened his resolve. Soon enough he would be gasping and sweating in damp, smoky darkness, one of thousands of men stumbling through a tunnel 8 feet wide, their steps barely illuminated by a few torches. The Roman camp within minutes was a beehive of activity. Long files of mounted soldiers started down the valley, headed for another small valley 2 days' ride away. That valley was also a beehive of activity. Karush and his miners had been preparing the deception for weeks now. Belisarius waited until the very end before he mounted up and followed. It was odd, he realized, how much he was going to miss the mountains. Odd when he thought of the many times he had cursed them. But the Zagros had been good to him when all was said and done, and he was going to miss the clean air. He drove out all regrets. Aid helped. Think of the sea breeze. Think of gulls soaring through blue skies. Think of... "The hell with all that," came Belisarius's cheerful retort. "All I want to think about is Venus rising from the waves." And that was the thought that held him through the miserable days ahead. His wife coming to meet him from across the sea. Dearest love. At a place called Carax. A place where Belisarius would lance a dragon's belly and show the new gods that they too, for all their dreams of perfection, still needed intestines. Carax. Belisarius would burn that name into eternity. But the name meant nothing to him. It was just the place where his Venus would rise from the waves. A name which was only important because a man could remember embracing his wife there, like so many men over so many years at so many places had embraced their wives after a long separation. Nothing more. "So is eternity made," said Aid gently, "out of that simple clay, and no other." Chapter 24. Maharashtra. Summer, 532 AD. Irini whispered a few words into her agent's ear. The man nodded, bowed, and left the room. Irini closed the door behind him. Kungus had ignored the interchange. Bent over the reading table in Irini's outer chamber, carefully writing out the assignment she had given him, Kungus had seemed utterly oblivious to the spy's arrival or his whispered conversation with Irini. But the moment the spy was gone, Kungus raised his head and cocked an eye toward her. Seeing the expression on her face, he turned away from the table completely. "Is something wrong?" he asked. Irini stared at him, blank-faced. Kungus rose from the chair. A faint frown of worry creased his brow. "What is wrong?" he demanded. Irini shook her head. "Nothing," she replied. "Nothing is wrong." With the air of a woman preoccupied by something, she drifted toward the window. Kungus remained in place, following only with his eyes. Once at the window, Irini placed her hands on the sill. She leaned into the gentle breeze coming from the ocean, closing her eyes. Her thick, lustrous chestnut hair billowed gently in the wind. Behind her, unseen, Kungus's hands moved, coming up, cupping as if to stroke and caress. But the movement was short-lived. In seconds, his hands were back at his side. Irini turned away from the window. "I need your advice," she said softly. Kungus nodded. The gesture, as always, was economical, but his eyes were alert. For a moment, as her mind veered aside into the hot place in her heart, Irini reveled in her own words. "I need your advice." Simple words, but words which, except for Belisarius and occasionally Justinian, she had never spoken to a man. Men, as a rule, didn't give advice to women. They condescended, or they instructed, or they babbled vaingloriously, or they tried to seduce. They rarely simply advised. She couldn't remember any longer how many times she had said the words to Kungus, and how many times in the weeks since the battle where they destroyed the guns he had simply advised. By sheer force of will, she jerked her mind back from that place in her heart. The fire was there, but it was banked for a time. She shook her head, smiling. "What is so amusing?" asked Kungus.
"I was just remembering the first time I met you. I thought you were quite ugly."
His lips made the little movement which for Kungus stood for a grin.
"No longer, I hope."
She gave no answer, but Kungus didn't miss the little twitch of her hands, as if she too wanted to stroke and caress. Irini cleared her throat.
"There's news. News concerning Dadaji's family. The location of his son has been found. The location where he was, I should say. It seems that several months ago, Dadaji's son was among a group of slaves who escaped from his master's plantation in eastern India. The ringleader, apparently. Since then, according to the report, he's joined one of the rebel bands in the forest."
Kungus smacked his hands together. For an instant, the mask vanished. His face shone with pure and unalloyed delight.
"How wonderful! Dadaji will be ecstatic!"
Irini raised a cautioning hand.
"He's in great danger, Kungus, and there's nothing I can do to help him. The Malwa have been pouring troops into the forests since they finally realized they can no longer dismiss the rebels as a handful of brigands."
Kungus shrugged.
"And so? The boy dies, arms in hand, fighting the Ashura who ravages his homeland. That is the worst. You think that would break Dadaji's heart? You don't really understand him, Irini. Beneath that gentle scholar is a man of the great country. He will do the rites weeping, while his heart sings with joy."
Irini stared at him, skeptically at first. Then with a nod, she deferred to his judgment, and reveled also in that deferral.
"There's more," she added. "More than news." She took a deep breath. "My spies found his wife also. A slave in a noblewoman's kitchen right in Kaushambi itself. Following my instructions, they decided it would be possible to steal her away. In Malwa's capital," she snorted, half chuckling, "noblemen don't guard their mansions too carefully."
Kungus's eyes widened. In another man, they would have been practically bulging. Irini laughed.
"Oh yes, she is here, Kungus, in Supara."
She nodded toward the door.
"In this very house, in fact. My man has her downstairs in the salon."
Now even Kungus's legendary self-control was breaking.
Here?
He gasped. He stared at the door. Then, almost lunging, he began to move.
We must take her to him at once. He will be so... Stop.
Kungus staggered to a halt. For a moment, staring at Irene, he frowned with incomprehension. Then his expression changed as understanding came, or so he thought.
She has been disfigured, he stated. Dishonored, perhaps. You are afraid Dadashi will...
Irene blew out a breath, half laugh, half surprise.
No, no.
She smiled reassuringly.
She's quite well, Kungus, according to my agent. Very tired, of course. He says she was asleep within seconds of reaching the couch. The journey was long and arduous, and her life as a slave was sheer toil. But she is well. As for the other...
Irene waved her hand as if calming an unsettled child.
My spy says she was not abused, not in that manner. Not even by her master. She wasn't a young woman, you know. That is his age.
She looked away, her jaw tightening.
With so many young slaves to rape after the conquest of Andhra, men simply beat her until she was an obedient drudge.
Her next words were cold, filled with the bitterness of centuries. Greek women had been raped too, often enough, and listened to Greek men and Greek poets boasting of the Trojan women.
Not even Dadaji will count that as pollution.
That is not fair, said Kungus harshly.
Irene took a deep breath, almost a shudder.
No, it's not, she admitted. Not with Dadaji, at least. Although,
she sighed, shaking her head.
How can any man as intelligent as he be so stupid?
It only took Kungus a second, perhaps, to finally understand her concern.
Ah,
he stared out the window for a moment.
I see.
He looked down at his hands and spread wide his fingers.
Tonight the Empress has called a council. She will finally decide, she says, which offer of marriage to accept.
The fingers closed into fists. He looked up at Irene.
You will state your opinion then for the first time. And you do not want Dadaji to refrain from arguing his because he feels himself so deeply in your debt.
She nodded. Kungus chuckled.
I never imagined Rome's finest spymaster would hold herself to such a rigid code of honor.
Irene made an inarticulate, sarcastic noise.
I hate to disillusion you, Kungus. I do this not from honor, but from simple...
She paused. When she spoke again, the acid-tinged sarcasm was gone from her voice.
Some, yes. Some,
she sighed.
It's difficult to manipulate Dadaji even for someone like me. It's a bit too much like maneuvering against a damn saint.
She reached up and wiped her face, restoring the spymaster.
But that is still not my reason. My reason is cold-blooded statecraft. Whatever decision the Empress makes will be irrevocable. You know Shakuntala, Kungus. She is as intelligent, I think, as Justinian.
She barked a laugh. She certainly has the willpower of Theodora. Then, shaking her head,
but she's still a girl in many ways. If she discovers in the future that one of her closest advisors, he is like a father to her, you know that, withheld his advice on such a critical matter.
The head shaking became vigorous.
No, no, no. That would shake her self-confidence to the very roots, and that we cannot afford. She may make the wrong decision, rulers often do, but her confidence must never waver, or all will be lost.
Kungus eyed her, head aslant.
Have I ever told you that you were a very smart woman?
Several times, she replied, smiling.
She cocked her own head, returning his look of amusement with questioning eyes.
You still have not asked, she said softly, what my opinion is. We've never discussed the matter, oddly enough.
He spread his hands.
Why is that odd? I know your opinion just as surely you know mine.
He dropped his hands and lifted his shoulders.
It's obvious. I even have hopes once we explain that Dadaji will be convinced.
Irene snorted. Kungus smiled but shook his head.
You are too skeptical, I think.
The thick, heavy shoulders squared. But we will know soon. He began to move toward the door, his head turned away. I think it would be best, Irini, if you spoke first.
I agree. It will strike the harder coming from an unexpected source. You will follow, of course, when the time is right.
He didn't bother to reply. There was no need. For a moment, never speaking, the man and woman in the room reveled together in that knowledge. Kungus had reached the door, but Irini spoke before he could open it.
Kungus.
He turned his head. Irini gestured at the writing table.
You can read now.
Kushan, rather well, and your Greek is becoming passable. Your writing is still very crude, but that is merely a matter of practice. His eyes went to the table, lingering there for a moment, then closed shut.
Why, Kungus? She asked.
Her voice was calm, but tinged with anxiety, and, yes, some pain and anger.
My bed has always been there for you, but you have never come, not once in the weeks since the battle.
Kungus reopened his eyes. When he looked at Irini, his gaze was calm, calm and resolute.
Not yet.
Irini's own gaze was not so calm.
I'm not a virgin, Kungus, she said.
Angrily, perhaps, or simply pleading. The Kushan's mask of a face broke in half. Irini almost gasped. She'd never seen Kungus actually grin.
I didn't imagine you were, he choked out.
He lowered his head, shaking it back and forth like a bull.
Shocking news. Most distressing. I am chagrined beyond belief. What shall I do?
As tense as she was, Irini couldn't restrain her laughter. Kungus raised his head, still grinning. But the question remained in her eyes. He took a few steps forward, reached out his hand, and drew her head into his shoulder.
I have this to do first, Irini, he said softly, stroking her hair. I cannot...
Silence while he sought the words.
I cannot tend to my own needs while hers are still gaping. I have guarded her for too long now, and this struggle, I think, is perhaps her most desperate. I must see her through it safely.
She felt his chest heave slightly from soft laughter.
Call it my own dharma, if you will.
Irini nodded, her head still nestled in his shoulder. She reached up and caressed the back of his neck. Slender fingers danced on thick muscle.
I understand, she murmured. As long as I understand.
She laughed once herself very softly.
I may need reassurance again, mind you, if this goes on and on.
She knew he was smiling.
Not long, I think, she heard him say. The girl is decisive, you know.
Irini sighed and ceased caressing Kungus's neck. A moment later, her hands placed firmly on his chest, she created a space between them.
So she is, she murmured. So she most certainly is.
Pushing him away now.
Go then. I will see you tonight at the council meeting.
He bowed ceremoniously.
Prepare to do battle, Irini Makrambolitisa. The dragon of Indian prejudice awaits your Roman lance.
Gaiety returned in full force.
What a ridiculous metaphor. It's back to the books for you. Barbarian oaf.
Chapter 25. It was late in the night before Irini spoke. The council had already gone on for hours. Irini craned her neck, twisting her head back and forth. To all outward appearance, it was the gesture of someone simply stretching in order to remain alert in a long, long imperial council. In reality, she was just trying not to smile at the image which had come to her mind. This isn't a council. It's a down, smile, down, damned auction. Her eyes atop a rotating head fell on the Empress. Shakuntala was sitting stiff and straight-backed on a cushion placed on her throne. The throne itself was wide and low. In her lotus position, hands at her side, Shakuntala reminded Irini of the statue of a goddess resting on an altar. The girl had maintained that posture and her stern countenance throughout the session with no effort at all, seemingly. That self-discipline, Irene knew, was another of Raghunath Rao's many gifts to the girl. Irene's head-twisting became a little shake. Stop thinking of her as a girl. That's a woman now, not more than 20, yes, and still a virgin, but a woman nonetheless. In the long months, almost a year now, since Irene had come to India, she had grown very fond of Shakuntala. In private, Shakuntala's imperious demeanor was transmuted into something quite different. A will of iron still, and self-assuredness that would shame an elephant. But there was also humor, and quick intelligence, and banter, and a willingness to listen, and a cheerful acceptance of human foibles. And that, too, was a legacy of Raghunath Rao. Not one of Shakuntala's many advisers doubted for a moment that the Empress, should she feel it necessary, could order the execution of 1,000 men without blinking an eye. And not one of those advisers, not for an instant, ever hesitated to speak his mind. And that, too, was a legacy of Rao. Irene's eyes now fell on the large group of men sitting before the Empress on their own plush cushions resting on the carpeted floor. The bidders at the auction. The envoys from every kingdom in India, still independent of Malwa, were there. Tamrapurni, the great island south of India, which was sometimes called Ceylon, was there. And in the past 2 weeks, plenipotentiaries from every realm in the vast Hindu world had arrived also. Most of these envoys had brought soldiers with them to prove the sincerity of their offers. The Cholan and the Tamrapurni units were quite sizable. Supara was packed like a crate, with soldiers billeted everywhere. But they smuggled through the blockade of the coast, or more often, marching overland from Kerala, they had come. Kerala, ruled by Shakuntala's grandfather, was there too, despite his treacherous connivance the year before with the Malwa assassination plot against her. Shakuntala had practically forced its representative Ganapati to grovel, but in the end she had allowed Kerala to join the bidding. Irene had never fully realized, until the past few weeks, the true extent of the Hindu world. She had always thought of Hinduism and its Buddhist offspring as religions of India. But like Christianity, those religions had spread their message over the centuries, and more often than not, spread their entire culture along with it. Representatives from Champa were there, and Funan, and Langasuka, and Taroma, and many others. The faces of those envoys bore the racial stamp of Southeast Asia and its great archipelagos, but beneath the skin, they were children of India in all that mattered. Nations sired by Indian missionaries, suckled by Indian custom, nurtured by Indian commerce, and educated in Sanskrit or one of its derivatives. Even China was there, in the form of a Buddhist monk sent by one of the great kingdoms of that distant land. He, unlike the others, had not come to bid for Shakuntala's hand in marriage. He had simply come to observe. But men, not royal envoys at least, don't travel across the sea in order to observe a stone. They come to study a comet. Shakuntala's rebellion had shaken Malwa. The world's most powerful empire was still on its feet and still roaring its fury, but it was locked in mortal combat with adversaries from the mysterious West, enemies who had proven far more formidable than the Hindu world had envisioned. And now, rising from the stony soil of the great country, Shakuntala's rebellion was hammering the giant's knees. If those knees ever broke. The independent kingdoms of the Hindu world finally had shed their hesitation. They feared Malwa still, were petrified by the monster, in fact. But Shakuntala had shown that the beast could be bloodied. Not beaten, perhaps, that remained to be seen. But even the vacillating, timid, fretful kingdoms of South India and Southeast Asia had finally understood the truth. Andhra had returned. Great Satavahana, the noblest dynasty in their world, was still alive. That empire and that dynasty had shielded South India and the Hindu lands beyond for centuries. Perhaps it could do so yet. All of them had come, and all of them were bidding for the dynastic marriage, and the bidding had been fierce. In the weeks leading up to the council, the canny Peshwa Dadaji Holkar had matched one proposal against another, scraping quibble against reservation until nothing was left but solid offers of alliance. At the council meeting itself, in the course of the hours, Dadaji had compressed those solid offers into so many bars of iron. Irene repressed a grin. Dadaji Holkar, low-born son of polluted Maharashtra, had outwitted and outmaneuvered and outnegotiated
the Hindu world's most prestigious Brahmin diplomats. Had any of them been told now that Dadaji himself was nothing but a low-caste Vaisya, a mere Sudra, in truth, in any land of India outside the great country, they would have been shocked from the tops of their aristocratic heads to the soles of their pure Brahmin feet. Distressed also, of course, at the thought of the pollution they had suffered from their many hours of intimate contact with the man. For the most part, however, they would have simply been stunned. "It's not possible! He's one of the most learned men in India, a scholar as well as a statesman." She could picture them gobbling their disbelief. "It isn't possible. He's the Peshwa of Andhra. How could great Satavahana, India's purest Kshatriya, have been fooled by such a man? Not possible." Irene's fight to restrain her humor became transformed into something much grimmer, something cold and calculating, and in its own way utterly ruthless. She too could be an executioner. Studying the Brahmin diplomats seated before the Empress, Irene's eyes began to glint. "I will show you what is possible, fools." It was time. The envoys had presented their offers. Dadaji had summarized the situation. It only remained for the Empress to make her decision. Irene couldn't have explained the little movements she made of head and hands and eyes, which drew Shakuntala's attention. Neither could the young Empress herself, but the two women had spent many hours in private and public discourse. Irene knew how to signal the Empress just as surely as the Empress understood how to interpret those signals. Shakuntala's head turned to Irene. The Empress's eyes seemed as bright as ever, probably to most observers, but Irene could sense the dull resignation in that imperial gaze. "I would like to hear from the envoy of Rome," stated Shakuntala. As always in public council, the Empress's voice was a thing to marvel at. Youthful, true in its timbre, but a fresh-forged blade is still a sword. A faint murmur arose from the diplomats. Shakuntala's eyes snapped back to them. "Do I hear a protest?" she demanded. "Is there one among you who cares to speak?" The murmurs fled. Shakuntala's eyes were like iron balls. The black-eyed pearl of the Satavahanas, she was often called. But black, for all its beauty, can be a terrifying color. Black iron smote clay. "You would protest?" she hissed. "You?" The statue moved slightly, a goddess with a little gesture of the hand dismissing insects. "After Malwa conquered Andhra and flayed my father's skin for Skandagupta's trophy, what did you do?" The statue sneered. "You trembled and quailed and whimpered and tried to hide in your palaces." The goddess spoke. "Rome, only Rome, did not cower from the beast." Shakuntala's next words were spoken through tight teeth. "Doubt me not in this, you diplomats. If Malwa is slain, the lance which brings the monster down will be held in Roman hands, not ours alone, not if all of us united could we do the deed. Our task is to shield the Deccan and do what we can to lame the beast." The diplomats bowed their heads. The Brahmins, for all their learning, were insular and self-absorbed to a degree which Irene, accustomed to Roman cosmopolitanism, often found amazing. But even they by now knew the name of Belisarius. A bizarre name, an outlandish name, but a name of legend nonetheless. Even in South India, even in Southeast Asia, they had heard of Anatha, and the Nahar Malka, where Belisarius drowned Malwa's minions. Shakuntala kept her eyes on their bowed heads, not relenting for a full minute. Black iron is as heavy as it is hard. During that long minute, while Indian diplomats again quailed and hid their heads, Irene sent a mental message to a man across the sea. He wouldn't receive it, of course, but she knew he would have enjoyed the whimsy. That man had spent hours and hours with her in Constantinople, days, rather, counseling Irene on her great task, explaining to a woman of the present the future he wanted her to help create. "Well, Belisarius, you wanted your peninsular war. I do believe you've got it. And if we don't have Wellington in the lines of Torish Vedrish, we have something just as good. We have Rao and the hill forts of the great country, and..." Her eyes fell on a hard, harsh, brutal face. And we've got my man, too. Mine. She gathered the comfort in that possessive thought and transformed softness into hard purpose. Speak, envoy of Rome, commanded Chikuntala. Irene rose from her chair and stepped into the center of the large chamber. Dozens of eyes were fixed upon her. She had learned that from Theodora. The Empress Regent of Rome had also counseled Irene before she left for India, explaining to a spymaster accustomed to shadows how to work in the light of day. Always sit in counsel and judgment, Theodora had told her, but always stand when you truly want to lead. Irene, as was her way, began with humor. Consider these robes, men of India. She plucked at a heavy sleeve. Preposterous, are they not? A device for torture almost in this land of heat and swelter. Many smiles appeared. Irene matched them with her own. I was advised once to exchange them for a sari. She sensed, though she didn't look to see, a pair of twitching lips. But I rejected the advice. Why? Because while the robes are preposterous, what they represent is not. She scanned the crowd slowly. The smile faded. Her face grew stern. What they represent is Rome itself. Rome and its 1,000 years. Silence. Again, slowly, she scanned the room. 1,000 years, she repeated. What dynasty of India can claim as much? Silence. Scan back across the room. The greatest empire in the history of India, the Maurya, could claim only a century and a half. The Guptas not more than two. She nodded toward Chikuntala. Andhra can claim more in years, if not in power, but even Andhra cannot claim more than half Rome's fortune. Her stern face softened just slightly. Again, she nodded to the Empress. The nod was almost a bow. Although, God willing, Andhra will be able to match Rome's accomplishment as future centuries unfold. Severity returned. 1,000 years. Consider that, noblemen of India. And then ask yourself, how was it done? Again she smiled and again plucked at a heavy sleeve. It was done with these robes. These heavy, thick, preposterous, unsuitable robes. These robes contain the secret. She paused, waited. She had their complete attention now. She took the time while she waited to send another whimsical mental message across the sea, thanking a harsh, cold empress named Theodora, born in poverty on the streets of Alexandria,